All right, so a couple of weeks ago, we began our survey in the Westminster Confession of Faith. And so far, we have considered, although in abbreviated form, the first and the second chapters, which deal with the Holy Scriptures and of God and the Holy Trinity. Well, today we will consider chapter 3 of God's eternal decree. The Cambridge English Dictionary defines decree as an official statement that something must happen. The Westminster Dictionary defines it as an order, usually having the force of law. Oxford says it this way: an official order issued by a legal authority. Well, Article 1 of Chapter 3 of the Westminster Confession puts it like this: God from all eternity did, by the most wise and holy counsel of his own will, freely and unchangeably ordain whatsoever comes to pass. Now let us stop right here for just a minute. This is one of those statements that may either invoke great fear or perhaps great comfort. Most people don't mind if God is ordaining some things in the world, but they get a little upset when we say that God ordains all things. The reason is that saying that God ordains all things means we have to reconcile some very difficult and confusing realities. For example, what does this say about sin and about evil? What does it say about pain and about suffering, about disease, about hunger, or about natural disasters? What does this say to our life and all of the complexities and issues of our day? Whatsoever does it mean some things? It doesn't mean the big things. It doesn't even mean the major things. Whatsoever means whatsoever. So what does this say then about the current events in the news right now, or the state of our world? But more personally, and this is where it gets hard for us, what does this say to the parent who just lost their child, the individual who's addicted to drugs, the lost job, the struggling marriage, the rebellious son or daughter, or the forgotten elderly? How we answer these questions will give us either an abundant and vigorous hope, or will cast us into a bottomless abyss of despair. For me, personally, I need a sovereign God. I need to know that everything that I can't understand is safely kept by an omnipotent, omniscient, righteous, and loving Creator. So then, how does one approach a topic that seems to be so perplexing? How can the statement that God freely and unchangeably ordains whatsoever comes to pass make sense? Or more importantly, how can we trust that statement, especially when our lives are falling apart? The framers of the confession, they were not just theologians. They were farmers. They were workers. They were husbands. They were fathers. They had families and crops. They were familiar with hardship and death. Do you know the average lifespan in the 16th century was 39.7 years? They remembered the Black Death Plague of 1347 that eventually killed 50 million people. Many of them would live to see the London Plague and live through it in 1665, in which nearly 8,000 people were dying every week. They were familiar with hardship. They were familiar with heartache. They were just not writing a bland theological document for a church. They had to square what the Bible revealed about God with their very own life experience. So how did they approach it? How did they approach the statement? They did so by receiving into themselves the expression of God's divine attributes. Frankly, they trusted that God was who he said he was. Remember last week we talked about the 102-word paragraph that listed the attributes of God? Remember the recurring quantifier, most wise and most holy, most free, most absolute, working all things according to the counsel of his own immutable and righteous will and for his own glory? Remember that? The quantifier was used to show emphasis on certain attributes in that statement. But the superlative quantifier applies to all of the attributes of God. They were not just descriptions of God's character, but they were revelations of God's very essence. He revealed the essence of who he is that we may be confident and safe because he has sovereignly ordained whatsoever comes to pass. So the very definition of God is the very foundation of our confidence that we are safe with whatsoever comes to pass. The Westminster Divines were very deliberate in crafting this statement because they knew that it was a very difficult concept. So we can trust it. Because he is loving and pure and holy and righteous and infinite and almighty and immutable and wise and free and merciful and long-suffering and abundant in goodness and truth and forgiving and all the rest. We can trust it because it is secure in the essence of who he is. Will not the judge of the earth do right? Genesis 18:25. So that's how the framers of the Westminster looked at it. They didn't look at it as if, well, you know, God must be a little bit evil because there's evil in the world, or I don't understand, Satan's really got his hand up on God and God's just trying his best to fight back. Oh, no. They were very confident and they were very sure because they stood upon the very foundation of the self-expression of God's own self. And so will you, and so will I. We all will stand upon that and that alone because there is no other explanation. Where else do you go? You have words. Wow. So there is no other option. But that stands, that falls then back upon that second chapter that I talked about last week, where we were trying to illustrate and trying to make the point that this was where the substance and the meat of this whole confession stands upon the self-expression of God himself. So the confession continues. Article 1, Chapter 3. Yet so, as thereby neither is God the author of sin, nor is violence offered to the will of the creatures, nor is the liberty of contingency of second causes taken away, but rather established. Now, we just read that God ordains whatsoever comes to pass. But this includes not only the ends, but also the means. I sometimes refer to this just fastidiously as God's ways and means of accomplishing what he has decreed. For example, God ordained that Christ would be crucified on the cross, but he used human instruments through which the crucifixion would come. In doing so, he neither forced, that is, without violence, nor compelled the Romans to put to death Jesus on the cross, but the Romans incurred actual guilt for their act. The means that God used to bring about his holy and his righteous will in this case was the wicked and cruel actions of the Romans. The ordaining of this event was the primary cause, and the decision of the human beings was the secondary cause. So if God is then not the author of sin, how did sin enter the world? How do we account then for suffering? How do we account for pain? How do we account for death? How do we account for any of the tragedies that we face in this life? Well, at this point, it's necessary to make a distinction. There's this distinction between what theologians will call the decretive will of God and the preceptive will of God. Theologians are pretty good at splitting theological hairs. But this is not a theological absurdity. This is simply a theological distinction. R.C. Sproul puts it this way: we distinguish between God's preceptive will, by which he commands our obedience through laws and commands and precepts, and his decretive will, by which he brings to pass whatever he decrees shall come to pass. God doesn't just ordain something to be. He ordains the necessary means by which what is going to be decreed is to happen. Everything in creation, including human beings, operate under established physical and spiritual laws. You don't believe me? Well, jump off a chair and see what happens. You are going to obey the law of gravity every time. It will win every single time. And there are other physical laws that you are bound to. We are just bound to it. You try to go live in Alaska without a jacket. How long are you going to last? It's just physical laws. We're going to talk about that next week in creation, about how we're made the way we are and what laws we are bound to obey. But there's also spiritual laws. There's a sense of morality. There's a sense of obligation. Where do all these come from? These laws affect our interaction in the physical world and in the spiritual world. Hence we see the distinction between those decretive acts of creation and preceptive acts of spirituality. This is God's creation. And he is in complete control of his creation, of his universe. He doesn't just create the universe and then let it go amok. You're not running around making your own decisions based on your own wickedness. Matthew tells us this, that there's not a bird that even falls out of the sky without his knowledge. Do you know how many birds fall out of the sky? Just in the United States, every day? Anybody know that? Well, it's estimated that 13.7 million birds fall out of the sky in the United States every single day. And yeah, sometimes cats get them. And sometimes all kinds of things happen and they get them. But you know what? No, not a one of them falls out of the sky because of old age. That number is around 1 billion birds every year worldwide. Every one of them was ordained to fall. But each one of them falls for various causes. God knows and, in fact, ordained each one. He knows his universe. He knows what's going on. He knows what's happening. He's not upset or afraid or nervous or anxious about any of it. Every fall, we watch brilliant red and yellow leaves fall from the trees. They randomly and sporadically appear to float to the ground without any order, without any rhyme or reason. They just float and they fall and then they land and then we rake them up or blow them up with the blowers. But God knows exactly where and how every leaf will fall. Every leaf. Where it's going to land. Before it ever lands, he knows. Because God knows the density of the leaf. He knows the weight of the leaf. He knows the shape, the volume, the design. He knows it all perfectly. He knows the wind speed, the air pressure, the moisture, the atmospheric conditions. He knows all the things that play into the cycle of the leaf falling. And by his ordination, he knows where it will land every single time because he knows his creation. He knows all these things because he ordained them. Not even a leaf randomly falls to the ground. Again, quoting R.C. Sproul, there are no maverick molecules. Everything that is because God ordained it to be and ordained the causes that were necessary to bring it to pass. Make no mistake about it. Satan did not get one up on God by deceiving Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden. The only reason that evil exists is because God ordained that it exist for reasons and purposes that we simply cannot reconcile. The fact that evil is present doesn't weaken our view of God. It strengthens our view of God. There are certain attributes of God that could not be known apart from the presence of evil. The Christian doesn't have to walk around baffled that a good and all-powerful God could somehow let evil slip in and ruin his creation. Oh no. On the contrary, the Christian can confidently assert that the existence of evil was allowed for a fuller, more comprehensive experience in the revelation of God's glory and attributes, as well as a graphic illustration of man's redemption. The problem continues against all of that to be the moral issue of sin. At this point, perhaps a quote from Greg Bonson may be useful. Actually, I'm going to paraphrase. But he said that God must have had some morally sufficient reason for evil to exist that we just don't know. Otherwise, it wouldn't be here. There is nothing that exists that he has not ordained. Absolutely. In fact, absolutely, with no question. If God is to be God, then he is the God of all things. If there is anything that is not of God, then we're all in trouble. All right, at this point, are there any questions or comments that you'd like to make in regard to what we've said so far?
It's always leveled against the Christian God that he can't exist because he's good. And all powerful, and yet evil is in the world. But it actually turns out that only the Christian worldview can account for the fact that evil is in the world with that quote she did of Greg Monster. We can explain why it's here. Non-Christians can't explain, first of all, because they can't define what evil is to begin with.
Secondly, it's often called the problem of evil. I see it as the non-problem of evil. Because the question of evil is sort of like an open question. Anytime you ask an open question, it simply means that there's a whole lot more questions that need to be asked before you can get to that question. And the question is not, why did God allow evil in the world? The question really is, why did God allow anything? Why did he create anything? Why did he create anything in the way he did? Why are we flesh and bone? Why are we not made out of steel or made out of some material that would not be subject to the elements that we live in? Why are we somehow, because of God's free and righteous will, ordained to get bit by mosquitoes? We do. Why is that? To me, those are the questions that you have to ask before you can even get to the question of evil. But I think the confession answers that question satisfactorily in the expression of God's attributes in the second chapter. I think that's kind of what they're leaning upon as they formulate this third chapter. All right, Article 2 then reads, thank you, Bill. Article 2 reads, although God knows whatsoever may or can come to pass upon all supposed conditions, yet hath he not decreed anything because he foresaw it as future or as that which would come to pass upon such conditions. All right, this speaks to the fullness of God's knowledge in or his omniscience in what he ordains. Chapter 2 affirms that God knows all things past, and present, and future, and that he knows not only everything that is, but everything that could possibly be at any time and in any circumstance. Now, I want to give you something to think about. Let me say this first. He knows all the contingencies, and yet at the same time, there is nothing contingently himself. That is, he does not need to wait for certain conditions to be met before he can know what's going to happen, because he already knows it. The fact that something is known of God preempts all possibility of variation. He knows it absolutely and completely and fully. I want to ask you a question. We ask these questions about our life all the time, but let's see if we can stand on a rock of certainty that will help answer some of those questions. We all ask the questions all the time, am I doing what God wants me to do? Right now, in this place, in my life, at this minute, am I doing what God wants me to do? Or is there something else that I'm supposed to be doing and I'm really out of the will of God and I'm trying to get there and I'm trying to understand how to love God and how to serve God and how to obey God, but I'm probably not where I need to be and I need to be somewhere. Why is it always that in our quest to love and serve God that it's always somewhere else than where we already are? If God has ordained everything that is, and we are where we are, and there are no contingencies, and he knows every possible scenario that could play out in our life, and we are where we are because we are now where he put us, then there is absolute certainty that we are where we need to be. Whether you like that or not, whether that's to your advantage or to your horror, that's where we are. Paul said, all things work together for the goodness for good to them that love God. He certainly did not say that all things were good. A lot of things that we go through in life that hurt. There's a lot of things we go through in life we don't understand. And half the time, we don't know for sure anything. But what we do know is that God does. And I want to tell you, where you are today is exactly where you need to be today. Now, tomorrow, God may change the whole world. You may find yourself in a whole different situation tomorrow. But today, you're where God puts you. If you're out of His word, out of His in disobedience, you know what? You're there because He's allowing you to be there, because He's going to turn you around. If you're His, you can't stay there. If you're in preparation for something, a greater call that He has for you, you're where you are right now. You're not there. You're right here. So be here. Look down at your feet. That is where you are. Be there. And see what tomorrow will bring. All right. Look at Article 3, please. By the decree of God, for the manifestation of His glory, some men and angels are predestined unto everlasting life, and others foreordained to everlasting death. Now let me begin this section by stating that the idea of predestination, not invented by John Calvin. John Calvin is not the author of predestination, nor is Martin Luther. Martin Luther did not wake up one morning and say, I think I'll create a doctrine called predestination and just confuse everybody. No, he didn't do that. It is a biblical concept. The word predestination appears in the New Testament, so Christians recognize that the Bible teaches some kind of predestination. Now, the time it would take to cover all the teaching concerning predestination is certainly beyond the scope of this class at this point, but I'm just going to be very brief in talking about this. Predestination is mostly viewed in a couple of ways. One is that God looked down through the, I'm talking redemptively speaking, that God looked down through time and He saw who was going to make a decision to believe in Jesus. And so He predestined them then to be saved. They're elected. And that's called election. And that's called predestination. It's sometimes called conditional election, based on the concept of prevenient grace. The other view is that election is based solely upon the decree of God, and not upon a person's decision. And this is referred as unconditional election. The confession states that although God knows what will happen, yet He hath not decreed anything. He hasn't decreed anything because He foresaw it as future, or as that which would come to pass upon certain conditions. Again, God has not decreed anything on the basis of His knowledge of future events. Instead, He knows all things in advance because He decreed all things in advance. Now, you may say, but I made a decision to believe in Jesus as my Savior. I did that. And it is true, you did. But the question is not, did you make a decision to believe in Jesus? The question is, why did you make a decision to believe in Jesus? And the only answer is that you were among the elect. Then what about the rest of mankind? Well, from a biblical perspective, I'm going back to Sproul here. It is safe to say, and though it is a difficult concept to grasp emotionally and logically, but God is glorified by the judgment of the wicked in hell just as much as He is glorified by the rescue of saints in heaven. It's a hard one, but that's a truth. Critics of Reformed theology say this makes God unrighteous. that God would ordain that mankind would fall, and then from fallen mankind elected, predestined some unto salvation. But beloved, I want to remind you of something that we're not going to get into as much, but Paul dealt with some of these same arguments. And he wasn't quite as accommodating in his answers. The scriptures speak quite frankly about this in the analogy of the potter and the clay. And besides that, the other side, that God looks down through the corridor of time, he says, oh yeah, Joshua, he's going to believe in me, so I'm going to elect him, and he's going to be predestined. And there you go. There's some problems with that as well. And if God looked down through time and he saw who would believe, then he also saw who would not believe. And if he saw that they would not believe, why did he create? The truth is that we're speaking of things we cannot know. We're trying to investigate and interrogate the mind of God. And I can't do that. You can't do that. We can't do that. We don't have it. What we do know is that the teachers teach foreordination and predestination very clearly and very evidently.